Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show Live. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Ricardo Teixeira. Ricardo, how are you this fine Friday afternoon?
It's a good day to have a good day. We've got a bit of rain. It's not too hot. Not a bad day.
Excellent, excellent. Your backgrounds always are drawing some interest for those watching YouTube. So what is in your background, just before we get into stuff?
This is the front of the INS Talwar, a Talwar-class frigate built by the Russians for the Indian Navy that I had the opportunity to go on. I believe another ship of the class will be attending Ipsamar this next month. But yeah. You know, trying to change it up a bit.
Very cool.
You got some missile tubes, VLS cells, anti-submarine rockets down here.
That's so if you are listening to the live show on audio only after the fact, do check us out on Fridays at 1:30, and then you get to see all of Ricardo's interesting backgrounds. Anyway, with that being said, let's get into the news of this week. And I guess we have to start off with the drama around some of the ANC's candidate lists in the lead up to the local government election. So let's start off with the ANC talking about there being a glitch which prevented them from submitting their lists on time.
Commission's candidate capture system experienced technical issues that affected a number of contesting parties. As a result, a small number of the movements and entries are being finalized together with the commission. Let me pause there. Did this happen? This capture system experiencing technical issues?
Yes, it did happen. Mm-hmm. And it did affect some of our municipalities and our candidates. Of course, alongside a number of other parties. Mm. But we're concerned about that because it is important considering the democratic and the rigorous and robust candidate selection process that the ANC goes through. And it's important that we do follow up on that matter. We don't consider it to be a matter that is closed because we do believe that whilst we trust the IEC processes and have no doubt about the integrity of the Independent Electoral Commission, it's important for the ANC to put it on record that we would have done anything and everything to ensure that all our candidates are lodged and uploaded onto the system. Indeed, all our candidates had already been uploaded onto the system of the IEC, the online system, which is what we elect to utilize.
Yeah.
But on the final day, a portion of our candidates were kicked out by the system.
Yeah.
And it may seem like a small number, but it's a significant number for the reasons I've just outlined.
So there you have the ANC claiming some mysterious computer glitch kicked a number of their candidates off of the IEC's candidate submission list. Now, it's not entirely clear yet which municipalities are affected by this. There's been some media reporting, and this was put together by our colleague, Ofense Davey, who's been looking at places where the media has reported this. Municipalities that have come up as apparently not having their ANC candidate list submitted: Walter Sisulu Municipality in Eastern Cape, Sundays River Valley, Nkukuza Hill, Port St. John's, OR Tambo District Municipality, Mswati, but only the PR list in KZN. And then, perhaps most significantly, apparently the issue affects some of their candidates in Mangaung, that is the municipality around Bloemfontein. So the scale of it, we don't know. Does it mean that the whole entire municipalities are just not going to have ANC candidates? Does it mean that some who are supposed to be on a list dropped off a list or aren't going to be appearing for awards? Not entirely clear. However, considering how the ANC is complaining about this, it does seem like whatever the situation is, it's a bit of a problem. Now, there has been some talk of the IEC and ANC coming to some sort of arrangement, and this has happened in the past. I think the ANC took the IEC to court when their list was late, and then in the end, the IEC ended up just adding them to, even though they were late. But here's the IEC saying they're not going to do that.
Tony, I really it's good that you I have to say, I have clearly said categorically, there is no avenue for reopening the submission of candidates on the IEC systems or even submitting manual. That is history. What I'm saying is, since Friday when we closed, the law makes provision that by the 4th of September, the Commission may request additional documents from the political parties that submitted by the deadline. You know, this may be copies of ID documents where maybe the copies that have been filed are not clear, to say give us a clear image or something like that. We're not talking to those who missed the deadline. We are saying before we go into the publication of the final list, we are not saying it will happen to everybody. We are saying for those that are now duly or who have duly submitted, we may ask for that information.
So, yeah, I mean, we don't entirely know what exactly has happened on the system, whether names were just not submitted, whether incomplete details were submitted. So maybe there is some wiggle room for something to slip in there. But Ricardo, this seems like yet another pre-election blunder for the ANC.
I would like to know if the technical issue they experienced was perhaps just an issue on their end, such as a slow laptop, bad internet connection. The IEC is being pretty serious. I mean, the guy said categorically, and that's how you know it's serious in South Africa. He's determined categorically. That's it. Finishing clock. I think it's pretty bad for the ANC, considering some of the very ANC names of some of those wards. You know, Oliver Tambo District, Walter Sisulu.
These are all municipalities the ANC got over 50% in.
Yeah.
Except for what the one in KZN.
And I think that those wards are now going to end, and municipalities are now going to potentially be hung. And it bodes bad for the ANC. And I think that given how, I don't know if I can say this, but how half-assed they've been in this entire election campaign, it's not surprising to an extent. But I think it is also emblematic of the larger issues the party is facing. I mean, guys, come on. And then saying that, no, they were on there, they just weren't submitted. If I go online and fill out a job application and don't hit submit, I haven't applied for that job.
Hmm. Now, what's also interesting about this is how they're sort of claiming that other parties are affected by this. But as far as I know, not a single one of the other major parties. Yeah, no. Maybe there's some small party we've never heard of that's had a problem. But the other big parties haven't had a problem at all, as far as we're aware. And there's a hidden danger in this, unfortunately, which is that if the IEC does make some sort of exception for the ANC, which would be very bad and I think probably illegal, but if it kind of gets, mushed through, there is something looming behind, and that is MK. Let's have a look
at this.
The Caesar Party has accused the IEC and the African National Congress of political double standards following reports of incomplete candidate list submissions. The MK Party demands a strict adherence to the set electoral deadline, warning the Commission against giving the ANC special accommodation or lenient treatment. Having met the candidate submission deadline itself, the MK Party insists that the ANC be held to the exact same standard without exception. A party spokesperson, Sfiso Mahlangu, joins us now for more. Sfiso, thank you very much for your time. I mean, in your statement, you say that, the IEC had essentially better not be planning on giving the ANC special accommodation. What would give you the idea that it would?
Well, we certainly hope that the IEC does not repeat the events of the 2024 election, as Mkhonto Sizwe Party were still in court with the IEC over that matter. But of course, there is historical knowledge that the IEC extended the deadline.
So there's the MK connecting this all to their claims that the 2024 election was stolen, which I think is pretty conclusively debunked. But if some sort of exception is made here, you can see that MK is going to use that as a reason to undermine the legitimacy of the elections, particularly if they don't win as big as they're hoping. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, MK is going to do what MK is going to do. And we all knew that that was likely going to happen. But I think it's, if anything, it's putting the ANC more in a, between a rock and a hard place. Because if they really want to say that none of the, you know, this election is unfair, they know they're going to be giving legitimate concerns to MK. But for the ANC to acknowledge that, you know, there were no technical issues and they just messed up, they're going to have to swallow their pride a little bit. Will they do so? We'll see.
Mm. And, of course, you know, this I think would be devastating to those, to the ANC's control of those municipalities, because they would have all sorts of issues. You know, suddenly these would fall into the opposition and these aren't ANC strongholds. It's a loss of patronage. All sorts of chaos would follow. So and something we're going to follow, and I think when the candidate lists come out properly, we'll see what the level was here. There's also been some accusations that some of this might have been due to ANC internal factional fighting, that someone on the ANC side, this is a speculation, there's no evidence being put forward on this front, was trying to remove candidates from the list so that their people could get in, all sorts of things like that. So a whole messy affair. And I think the real person who's going to suffer from this politically is Fikile Mbalula, because whether it's his fault or not, as Secretary General, he's responsible for this kind of thing. And I wonder if this ends up being as big of a problem as it looks like it could be, he may well not succeed in his bid to become the next leader of the ANC.
Yeah, I think that this campaign and his management of particularly this internal ANC registration for the election has well and truly been Fikile-led. And I think, yeah, it's going to look quite bad for him. All he had to do was just make sure things went smoothly. I mean, in the past, the ANC has had a very well-oiled electioneering machine. It seems they are in need of some WD-40, maybe some olive oil, just something to get the wheels going. It's the wheels on the bus are not going round and round, it seems.
Yeah. No, it's kind of shocking, actually, considering that they are still the country's biggest political party, to be encountering problems like this. Anyway, let's go on to questions. So if you're interested in asking a question on the show, put it in the comments, put it in the live chat, or email it to info@dailyfriend.co.za. This week we have a couple of questions from Dave. Dave writes in to say, number one, what is the situation of the national dialogue? Now, this is a
good question. The Madlanga Commission has paused for 2 weeks.
Oh, well, that too. But I haven't been sure, because apparently the national dialogue was supposed to be heading into its next phase, which was consulting in smaller groups with the whole country on various sectors. And according to their X account, their last social media post was on May 18th, where they say, the National Dialogue Steering Committee adopts pilot dialogue implementation framework for rollout phase. Now, apparently this means that trying to read through the incredibly poorly written media statement here, it seems like what they're going to be doing is testing out how they can take the national dialogue to the people, and they're supposed to be running this between June of this year and August. So in other words, it's supposed to have been finished and us moving on to the next stage. So I think we can say that at least for now, the indications are that the national dialogue is not looking too healthy. In fact, I think we may declare it deceased. Perhaps one of the most amusing damp squibs in recent South African political history. Cyril Ramaphosa big up this. He talked this up very big. And it's just kind of been an embarrassment.
Yeah. I think particularly considering it was meant to bring the social conversation forward. And it has, the social conversation has gone in ways not particularly constructive. You know, we had March, the June 30th deadline. We've had the Butlanga Commission, which is more complicated than the season of Days of Our Lives. And we've also had an election season, and it's been pretty clear how people feel about certain problems in this country. Maybe the national dialogue bit off more than it can chew.
Yeah, it's also a reminder that we didn't need a national dialogue because we have a free media and we have a national dialogue every single day in this country. We have elections, we have media. That's what the national dialogue is. Anyway, his next question is, why are opposition parties not making more hay about the Matlanga Commission of Inquiry of ANC deployment in top police appointments? And I went to look at some of the opposition parties' websites and things, and they are indeed putting out statements about this. But it's not really breaking through in a big way in the mainstream media. I think it is breaking through a bit on social media here and there. But Ricardo, you and I were talking about this before the show, and I just think the problem with the Matlanga Commission is just so much detail and so many characters. It's really hard to get into that story as an opposition party. What's your
thought? There's so much being uncovered on a weekly basis that, I mean, even for myself, I mean, I'm tracking it because of the Blueprint for Growth paper that we write at the IRR. And it's difficult to keep on top of the ball, man. And even for the journalists that cover it full time, I know it can be quite overwhelming. I mean, I sit at the end of every week and try and like catch up and say, okay, what exactly has happened? What has occurred of note? What evidence has been presented? It's a lot. And I think that they, when it concludes, which I think is still quite a distance away because it seems every week there's a new branch of the tree that's uncovered, there's going to be a lot to say. And I think that there's going to be a lot of recommendations. It's very overwhelming to an extent. And I think it is important to question the ANC cadre deployment within the security cluster, not just the police, but I think that, you know, as a country, we should start asking, how do people get chosen to be a general in the SANDF? To what extent is cadre deployment involved in the military, in the police, and in the state security agency? And I think that, yeah, lots more to come on this.
Yeah, no, I think that, unfortunately, this isn't going to make the big... I mean, I think some of the impact has already happened because it's just been a couple of dramatic events and things. But I think that the sort of seeping into the public consciousness in a really fundamental way is only really going to happen after the thing concludes and we kind of sum it all up. I think people get the top line story that there's a lot of corruption in the police, just confirms what everyone thought. But the specific details of what exactly happened and who the biggest villains are is probably only going to be summarized at the end. And so, until that point, I think we're just going to have to see how it develops.
If there's one thing I can add, Feroz Khan has been fired by SAPS over an expedited...
There have been arrests, which is much better than many of these commissions.
Despite being charged in four separate cases, Julius Mkhwanazi is still only suspended.
With pay.
With pay. What's going on, guys? Come on.
Yeah, well, Ekurhuleni Municipality is that's what the opposition should be campaigning on in Ekurhuleni Municipality. We'll actually fire.
What does he have to do to actually get fired?
Must be nice to have that kind of job security. Anyway, let's move on to our next topic. Now, Ricardo, you were watching President Ramaphosa's visit recently to Donnell, and he was inspecting all sorts of armaments and weapons. But, well, let's just play the clip.
And the equipment that supported in the aircraft are from
different... I want people to note the background as they pan. Back there. Donnell is certified to work on all Russian helicopters. They are a maintenance and overhaul certified service provider for Russian helicopters, but you don't actually see them work on them much. I know they signed that MOU, I think back in 2019 or 2021, and they've recently had talks, the Defense Forces had talks with the Russians. But what is it worth? Because we don't operate any of that equipment ourselves. Granted, some of our neighbors do, but it's in small numbers, but we don't seem to be maintaining their stuff. But that is a potential avenue for revenue for Donnell that just doesn't seem to have gone anywhere except be a poster in the background.
This was a genuine public participation program when it was developed. It developed the whole industry of defense sector. So currently, it's...
And then as they pan, you'll see there that, so that what you're seeing there is the nose of the Royfok. And from the bottom up, you're seeing the 20 mil cannon, which doesn't currently work on any of the Royfok airframes. I know people think that we have this magical huge number of Royfoks. We only have 11 airframes, all right? And one of the big problems for the Royfok platform is obsolescence. So starting from the front there, the cannon doesn't work. Above it, that big round thing, that's a radar. That doesn't work. Above it is a sight and an optics system. That also is obsolete and doesn't work. Notably, that little light brown square there is covering of the nose number of the aircraft. This is airframe 676, which has been at Denel for quite some time. But it seems that it did at least get a paint job and the cannon put back on, because previous photos I've seen from it early in the year, there was no cannon attached. Now, I do know that this one is working to some extent. Mechanically, they are all able to fly because, you know, once you fix an engine, you fix an engine. But when it comes to the electronic systems aboard the Royfok, it's past the point of obsolescence. They can fly, but they can't do much else. And the big point of this whole visit here was showing the president this indigenously designed attack helicopter, which, as they say, was a public-private partnership that supported multiple companies. But it is in desperate need of an upgrade and funding, because if not, these things are never going to fly again. And in 2 years' time, we won't have any left.
It is facing a bit of obsolescence. So we are going
to... And you can note that they said that it's facing a bit of obsolescence.
So let's have a look at a couple of pictures from this. Here's the president getting a chance to sit in the seat of the Royfok, looking about as happy as I think I would, actually, to be honest.
Yeah, I would have the same look on my face. So where he's sitting there is what you call the WISO seat, the weapon systems officer seat, which is in front, and the pilot seat's back and high, so the better observation. But you'll notice if you look behind the pilot seat that the engine bay is open and there is no engine in there. No gearbox either. This one's currently being worked on, but it did receive a new paint job. And yeah, Mr. President, I would have the exact same look on my face. And I've said to my friends in 16 Squadron who operate the Royfok that if they can, take Cyril for a spin. When I was in India earlier this year, one of the things we saw was the Indian president take a spin in the indigenous Indian light attack helicopter, the Prashant. And just showed the support for the platform. And I think people forget that at the end of the day, the biggest salesperson for a country's defense products is the president. He is salesman number one. Every foreign visit he goes on, I mean, just look at Donald Trump. Every time he goes to Saudi Arabia, they sign a defense pact. Every time Macron goes to the Middle East, someone buys a Rafale. And I think that the president needs to start playing a bigger role here. And it's good to see him go to these facilities and to see what we actually have. Unfortunately, a lot of it's no longer in production and is struggling to be maintained.
So I guess that raises a sort of larger question about Denel and our arms industry. Of course, because of the sanctions during apartheid, South Africa developed this pretty sophisticated indigenous arms manufacturing capacity. And we produced things like the G5 artillery system, the G6 artillery system, and some of our
infantry fighting vehicles,
the Roy and the Royfok. So, you know, South Africa has produced some good stuff, but partly for understandable reasons and partly for not understandable reasons, that has dropped off a bit, a lot since the end of apartheid. And you can see now, as you were just describing, right, our platforms are getting obsolete now. Some of our other projects, like I think it's called the Badger you've talked about before.
Yes, Project Hoofaster. So I did send you some pictures of that if you want to throw them up. So I love talking about Project Hoofaster because it's a classic example of a project that was put as a priority when it shouldn't have been. So if you want to overhaul a military, you don't start with the high-end combat vehicles. That's the last thing you do. You start with the logistical train. You start with your trucks, your armored personnel carriers, your everyday mobility vehicles. And there was a project linked to both of those called Projects Vistula and Project Sapula, which were supposed to replace the Mamba, Casper, and the Samuel trucks. But instead, Project Hoofaster, which translates to horseshoe, was given the priority to replace the Rattle infantry fighting vehicle, which has now been in service for 50 years. Now, Project Hoofaster started in the early 2000s, and I believe it was May 2007. The design choice was awarded to the consortium with Patria, which is a Finnish company, for what was then the AMV, but the local variant, the Badger, that you see on screen there. Now, if you look at the front of the vehicle there, below the mirror, above the front wheel, you'll see that that assembled vehicle still says Patria on it. Because the first 14 vehicles that the NEL loves to show off at exercises and at displays were not actually built by the NEL. They were built by Patria and developed and delivered fully assembled. And the NEL then worked on about 28 hulls that are in varying degrees of assembly, and they have enough spare parts to and kits to put together approximately another 100-120. But despite that, having started in 2007, when I was 9 years old, to date, not a single vehicle has been delivered.
Yeah, that's absolutely crazy. So this kind of highlights my point. Should we actually continue to have something like the NEL, or should we really just sort of chop it up, sell it off, salvage what we can, and buy foreign?
No, buy foreign only where necessary. And I think for the high-end products that we have never been able to develop ourselves, such as ships, submarines, fighter jets, and helicopters, but particularly troop-carrying helicopters, we need a lot more of those. The 1996 white paper called out a need for a minimum of 94 medium-lift helicopters. We never got anywhere near that, but that was the minimum requirement for what the government saw the defense was having to do back in the late 90s. Now, the NEL, I think the best thing that the government can do for the NEL is get out of the way. If you talk to a lot of people at the NEL and a lot of people within the defense industry, there's two big problems at the NEL. Firstly, a terrible board. If you look at the board of the NEL, you don't see anyone with industry experience. It's just accountants and lawyers, which does not bode confidence in a defense company. Secondly, the political interference within the company in terms of the appointments of the board, the way projects are done, and the import-export market, and how it's overseen by the National Conventional Arms Control Committee. The best thing the government can do is get out of the way. Take the NEL, have a holding company that oversees the different divisions, and then, you know, invite public private participation. The government doesn't have to give up the entire control of the company, just give up management control and let people who know what they're doing run it. And at the end of the day, streamline it. I mean, there are so many companies in South Africa that make armored personnel carriers. The NEL doesn't need to make armored personnel carriers. The NEL can focus on artillery systems, it can focus on missiles, it can focus on drones, it can focus on small arms. But focus where it's actually important and ensure that any foreign products that are brought into service, the NEL can support them. But the NEL can't do everything. And the government has this view that it must remain fully under state control and it must do everything and it must integrate everything. And that's all good and well when you can do it. But if you've repeatedly demonstrated an inability to do anything and to finish any project on time, and you have heaps of corruption and wasteful and irregular expenditure and missed timelines, if you keep doing the same thing over and over again and you expect a different result, that is the literal definition of insanity. And I think that if we want the defense industry and the defense force to have things turn around and to be capable again, firstly, the government needs to provide funding. The government needs to support a realistic plan, but they also just need to get out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's very, very correct. All right. Very briefly, Ricardo did not want to talk about this because he is so tired of talking about this. But last weekend, we, of course, had the controversial flyover of the Springboks versus New Zealand rugby match by Airlink. And it was quite impressive. And just for those who haven't seen or have seen from one angle and not this angle, here's a clip of that.
Watch the pyrotechnics hit the second plane.
So, Ricardo, you didn't want to talk about this because of everyone having an opinion and everyone talk about the safety and all that. And
everyone's an aviation expert now.
Yeah, no, there's many such cases when people on social media, it's that new thing becomes the hot topic. Everyone has suddenly newfound expertise. That being said, what I found very interesting about this was seeing this was a rare moment where South Africa kind of broke out into spaces on social media that it often isn't, like, for example, sort of discussions in open source intelligence groups and aviation community and that sort of thing online, and how South Africans were out there having aggressive, jingoistic, nationalist chest
beating, flag waving South Africans going, "But did you die? No."
You had everyone from sort of Freedom Front Plus, proud sort of Volkstaat Afrikaans men to like EFF sort of racial nationalists, and everything like, in between was for 1 minute standing together on social media, being very obnoxious and aggressive towards anyone who criticized this flyover. And I find that very interesting because it reveals what is so often denied, I think, by many people, which is that there is actually quite a strong sense of South African national identity, which is truly multiracial. And it does exist out there in our society. And it's only when there's a feeling like we're under attack that you get everyone reacting so boisterously, really aggressively. So I thought that was very interesting from a sort of sociological point of view. Ed, do you have any thoughts?
I did see one comment on X or Twitter, because I'm still an adult, where someone spoke about the casual South African tolerance for insane amounts of risk that we just shrug off on a day-to-day basis by just living with taxi drivers and everyone being like, "You think that was low? We can go lower." Like, I think we're a little bit nuts sometimes. And makes me a little bit proud.
Yeah, no, there is something sort of charming in it. Whether that flyover was a good idea or not, I will leave to the
actual. It was not a good idea, but, you know, no one died. There was no crash. It went
perfectly. Yeah, that's the important thing.
You could only pull off something like this with serious amounts of experience, because the margin of error was so low. But the only thing that gets you through pulling off something like that without crashing is experience. I will continue to fly SAF Air, though.
I actually, like, last weekend was flying Airlink. I love Airlink. I think they're cool. Not sponsored, but I way prefer them to
stick with SAF.
In fact, I think I flew to Cape Town on that specific on one of the jets in that flyover. Anyway, that's not important. Anyway, I think your larger point is right. You know, South Africans are used to living in violence, chaos, and disorder, and risk. And it builds a sort of a thick skin, which is actually sort of an advantage, particularly if we can get some of the basics right, because I think that attitude can help you to overcome a lot of problems. So something to think about.
Yeah.
Anyway. With that, I think we're going to call it to a close there. Thank you very much, everyone, for watching the show today, listening to us online, and we will see you next week on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone, and have an excellent and wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.